Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another interview episode for this season of Movie Rob Minute, season 11, where we were discussing the miniseries Band of Brothers from 2001, 5 minutes at a time. Today is another interview episode because it's the end of part two, episode 27. And today I had the pleasure to have a nice talk with Eric Flint, who is a military historian. He's also one of the tour guides for the Band of Brothers tour from Normandy all the way to the Eagle's Nest. So sit back once again and enjoy this conversation that I had with Eric Flint. So hello, Eric. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. Where does it all start? Like, how are you connected to the whole idea of Band of Brothers? Or do you want to even go further back and explain how you became interested in becoming a military historian, you know?
I had about a 35-year career in the military, the U.S. military, between the Marine Corps and the U.S. Army. Retired as a lieutenant colonel. I have an undergraduate degree in history. I have a graduate degree in land warfare studies. You know, that's pretty common.
Okay.
I've done some civilian work as a historian. I was a historian in uniform, particularly for United States Special Operations Command. My time in Iraq was spent as a combat historian. But about 1998, I read this great book called Band of Brothers, and I've never heard of it.
I've never heard of that one.
No. Well, if you get a chance, pick it up.
I'll see if I can find it. It might be really hard to find, so I don't know.
Yeah. So, well, if you dig, you might get a used copy.
Oh, wait a second. I have it on my shelf. Okay. There you go.
So I had read this book, and it was really neat. And I had some friends who were World War II reenactors, and they were doing an event in Oregon State at the Oregon Military Museum for Armed Forces Day, I think I can't remember if it was 98 or 99. Anyway, I went down to see those guys, and I happened to be, the ironic thing is I'm standing there talking to these guys, and a couple of them had also recently read Band of Brothers, and they're like, wow, what a great book. We see a gentleman with a white jacket with a big 101st Airborne Screaming Eagle on the back.
Oh, wow.
And he kind of walks up to us, and we're like, wow, sir, were you in the 101st? And he says, yes. And then, wow, were you in World War II? And he says, yeah. And I asked him, what regiment? He said, oh, I was in the 506th.
Wow.
Which battalion? Second battalion. Which company? He said, E Company. And I said, sir, what's your name? And he said, oh, my name's Don. And I went, Don Malarkey?
Don Malarkey, exactly.
Yeah, and Don looks and goes, what? He goes, how do you know who the hell I am? So I told him. Anyway, by the way, for historical accuracy, there may be some profanity, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Good.
You can do whatever the fuck you want.
Good. Because at that point, Don says, hey, you know, that I was interested. And he said, that's great. Hey, we're having a reunion coming up in October down in Denver. Here, give me your phone number and I'll have Bill Garnier give you a call. You should come down. And the next day I get this phone call. And the guy goes, yeah, hey, is Eric there? And I'm speaking, Eric, Bill Garnier, how the hell you doing? And I'm just, oh my God, I'm fine, sir. And he, God damn it, don't call me sir. Bill says, hey, Don tells us you want to come down to the reunion. Think that's great. Come on down. So I flew down and spent about 3 or 4 days. When I got there, they had just announced the miniseries. And so I ultimately found out that most of the veteran interviews that are in the series, where you see them being interviewed with mm-hmm. just a a black background was filmed at the DoubleTree Hotel, Denver Airport. And that's where I met Bruce McKenna, and a few other guys. But probably one of the most important people I met was, apart from Don and Bill and Babe and Buck and all the guys, was I met a guy named Chris Anderson. And Chris, my age, and Chris had grown up with these guys. He lived near Dick Winters and had known Dick Winters since he was probably a teenager. And he's a big, just little kid who was a World War II nerd, and he knew all of these guys. And again, this is before the book, before the series.
Right.
It just happened. And at the time, Chris was the editor of Military History Quarterly. He would go on to become the editor of World War II magazine. And he and I became friends, and eventually he designed, refined the Band of Brothers tour that the Stephen Ambrose Historical Tour Company would offer several years later. And so I've been going to the Band of Brothers reunions for a few years. And let's see, we did a small sort of normal reunion in Biloxi, Mississippi in 2000. And it was at a Holiday Inn, it was nice near the water. But the thing was, HBO was picking up the bar tab. So they had a hospitality suite with free liquor. And it was so much fun just getting to talk to all the guys. I can remember standing with Carwood Lipton, who happens to be one of the most elegant humans in the world. He's one of the few people that could actually wear an ascot and get away with it. That was the first time Carwood told me the whole story about climbing up the tree at Braecor Manor and, not realizing that he wasn't bulletproof. Got to meet, several of the kids, and we did that for about 3 days. But then HBO drove us all over to New Orleans, put us up at a very nice hotel, and we were there for the opening of what is now the World War II Museum. But at the time, on June 6, 2000, it was the National D-Day Museum.
Okay.
And in fact, it was all about Normandy. It didn't have anything about the Pacific. They were talking about opening up a Pacific wing, hopefully one day. But like Stephen Ambrose was there and he spoke, and Tom Hanks was there and spoke, and Tom Brokaw. Probably the most wonderful thing that of anybody that got up and spoke is all Tom Hanks did is he walked out on stage, got out a piece of paper, and just read the correspondent Ernie Pyle's descriptions of what Omaha Beach looked like.
Wow.
About 3 days, and no introduction, read that, and then walked off stage. Absolutely fantastic. But just that was neat because so many veterans who might not have been able to come and some of their family members, because HBO picked up a lot of the tab. And then the big thing was the following year in 2001, when they actually had the miniseries premiere. And that for that, I was actually in Normandy doing some graduate work. On my master's. And so the thing was, HBO was going to have the miniseries premiere on Utah Beach, essentially as part of the official commemoration on June 6th. And about 4 months ahead of time, I get a phone call from Bill Garnier. And Eric, hey, all right, I need to update your address. And I had moved. And he said, "Is it different? What the f*** is wrong with you kids today? I've been living in the same house since 1946. What the hell's wrong with you kids? Anyway, so, but Bill then says, he goes, okay. He says, all right, Eric, I want you to call this broad in New York. Her name is Merev, I think, or something. Anyway, tell her you're my nephew. And I'm like, okay, Bill. So I call the HBO office, and a lovely woman named Merev Brooks says, oh, Mr. Flint, Mr. Garnier's nephew. Well, we have your credentials for the premiere. And so I'm in Normandy. My then wife is with me as well. And we went to the premiere, and everybody had credentials, and we had E Company family credentials. My friend Chris Anderson was there. In fact, he was escorting some of the veterans themselves. But it was the first time that Ron Spears had been to a reunion in years, and he and Dick Winters hadn't seen each other, and, you know, almost since the war, were there. They had the official ceremony. It was, you didn't know who any of the actors were, because they were all no-name kids at the time, and you know, apart from David Schwimmer.
Most of them are also now, you know, no name.
But... Yeah. Who knows this Michael Fassbender or Simon Pegg or, you know, yeah. I am keeping my eye on that young Jimmy McAvoy. I think he might go somewhere.
He might. He has a good death scene.
He might.
You know, it's
still funny when I watch something and I'm going, oh my gosh, I forgot he started. So apart from Schwimmer and Wahlberg, and it was funny. My wife and I were playing a game called Spot the Actor, and we did that. You know, well, what we noticed is we saw Schwimmer and Donnie Wahlberg, who were recognizable, and that they were wearing black sport coats or black leather jackets, a blue collared shirt, and black pants. But then we noticed all these other younger kids. When I say kids,
right,
20s, and they're wearing the same uniform, except they have a black shirt on. And we're like, oh, they must be, you know, I'm military. My ex-wife was a Navy officer, so we're saying they're in uniform. And we'd wait for them to turn around, and we'd see if they had E Company or, you know, Bander Brothers actor. And so, yeah, they were in uniform. It was pretty easy to tell who the actors were, because, you know, they weren't as cool as Schwimmer and Wahlberg, though, but I think they're doing okay now. But it was probably one of the neatest things about being at the premiere was getting to see, you know, lovely seeing Don and Bill and Babe and, you know, all these guys. So for the premiere itself, they had a huge banquet hall temporarily. And then half of this massive tent was a movie theater. And so they showed a few scenes of the very first episode. We watched all of episode 2, Day of Days, and then they showed little bits and pieces of the remainder of the series. The moment where the audience had the biggest response was at the end of Day of Days, when Malarkey and Garnier and some of the other guys are sitting in the back of the truck, and Dick Winter sticks his head in and says, oh, I'm not a Quaker.
Yeah.
And Frank John Hughes, the young kid who played
Quaker.
Bill Garnier, goes, and he nailed Bill's laugh. And everybody in that audience knew Bill. And the whole place just absolutely lost it. You know, this wonderful moment of, okay, they got it right. And and so after the series, I was able to do one more reunion after that. About that time, I got called back to active duty and spent about the next 10 years. But I kept in touch with the vets and their family members. I was very lucky in 2007. I was able to get some time off in the military, and my friend Chris Anderson was doing a tour, and Buck Compton and Don Malarkey were coming along. We got to take Buck and Don. We started in England and all the way down to Austria. And I just had a, you know, it's amazing. I walked the field at Braycore Manor with both of them. I went to all these, all these places with them. It was really an incredible experience. And so now I've been doing tours with Stephen Ambrose because of Chris Anderson. Chris Anderson called me about 12 years ago and said, "Hey, we need people. We're doing a big D-Day 70th anniversary. Would you like to help?" And I did that, and the company liked what I did. And so I would do one or two tours a year. I was either on active duty in the military, or I was running a U.S. Army museum as a U.S. Army civilian, which.
Right. The tours that you were doing were specifically Band of Brother tours, or not necessarily?
Well, I was doing a lot of Europe. We call them like Overlord or D-Day to the Rhine. But at the time, we only did a couple of Band of Brothers tours a year, and very much rightly so, the standards to lead those were pretty high. And so it was Chris Anderson would lead them. In fact, it wouldn't be till 2000, gosh, get my brain here, 2019 that I was authorized. Basically, I got certified by Chris to lead the tour.
Oh, wow.
Because it's very specific, and even though I knew the guys, we wanted to make sure that we did the tour correctly. And so
Right, of course.
but so we went from doing three Band of Brothers tours a year to I think we now do 13.
Wow.
And
But you don't need 13, do you?
I don't lead 13. I did 4 this year, since I retired from the museum, but it's been a very deliberate process to when, we have phenomenal historians who work for us, but it's like, we have guys who know campaigns, know areas, and so they can go right into those tours and, kind of, I wouldn't say do them cold, but they can do the
Right.
Band of Brothers is special, because it's such a personal thing. And so right now, Chris and I are the only two historians who do the tours, who knew the guys. We have a few other historians who do them who are phenomenal. They know the story. They know. That's the neat thing about this particular tour that we do is that we're talking about people that our guests can engage with. Also, we play the entire series as we go through. So it's this incredible framing device to. People have read the book, and then we're watching the miniseries, and in some cases we'll watch an episode before we go to the actual place. So
Right.
sometimes
And then
we'll,
the next day you're like, "Hey, do you remember when you saw this and this? That was here."
or
That's
sometimes we'll,
so cool.
and sometimes we'll actually go to a piece of ground and then watch the series. It's kind of how it's funny. Sometimes that way is better.
Wow. Yeah, but none of it was filmed in the actual places, was
No,
it? I don't think so.
and one of the like for instance, the Crossroads attack in the
In
Netherlands,
episode 5.
that as far as wow, did they really get the real estate when they shot it in England, but they found a place that looks stunningly like the real one. And they did that for everything, but really the Crossroads, because it was all filmed outdoors. And when we go into Bastogne and the attack on Foy and to walk the actual town of Foy and to go, this is where Ron Spears actually, ran across through the German positions over to, to link up with the 3rd Battalion guys. And then this is where he ran back. And that's the comment that we get most from guests is, especially the ones who've read the book and seen the series and read each of the veterans' books and all of that. They say, yeah, I thought I knew all this stuff until I got to walk the ground. And
Wow, that's just really cool. How many people are usually, what's the average number of people that are on one of these tours?
usually have the largest we'll have is about 35. And it's a historian, a tour manager, and we have all our drivers are Dutch. So they all know all these places inside and out. They can get a big, nice luxury tour bus in and out of little tiny areas. But it's just the right size that we can really get the groups get to know each other. And I'm there all day to answer questions and tell stories, and it's I can't believe I get paid to do it. But what's wonderful is how it continues to resonate. I can remember after the 70th, my first time, the tour company was like, okay, Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers, it's all big, but now it's going to wane. And then the 75 years later, we did the 75th, and that was even bigger. And it was our Band of Brothers tours, and
Wow.
it's just continued to grow, and the interest is still there, and we're seeing younger guests come. So it's wonderful to see that the interest is still there, and people want to do it, and it's not dying down by any means.
Right. Wow, that's just amazing. Okay, so when you mentioned before that you were on the tour with both Buck and Don, what was their reactions to being back in those spots again? I mean, I'm assuming it wasn't the first time they were there
No.
since they were there originally, but what was maybe you can like tell me and everyone listening, the idea of was there what was the emotional level that they were feeling in these places, or after 70 years, that changes.
As we're, say, for instance, walking the field at Braycore Manor, it was so something like that wasn't like deeply emotional. I mean, it was emotional for those of us who were there.
Right.
But Buck and Don were, kind of like, yeah, I came over here and, I didn't know what the hell I was doing, and, forgot to
Well,
pull a pin on.
I was trying to get a Luger,
Yeah,
I was like.
and Don talking about, yeah, I ran out here. And actually back then, Charles de Vollaville, who is the grandson of the head of the manor there during World War II, who still runs it. It's a working farm. Of course, Buck and Don and other veterans had been back there, but we got to be treat-fetted by the de Vollaville family and got some
Oh, wow.
bathtub Calvados that Charles made. And so it was, I wouldn't say it was mad. It wasn't, it felt like kind of matter of fact when we would go to different places because they're telling us about it. The one place where there was real emotion was at the cemetery in the Netherlands.
Okay.
And when we visited the grave of Skip Muck,
Okay.
who was, Don's best friend, and that was Don, still very physically fit, able to move, and but he knelt down to put some flowers there, and you could Don's a very emotional, passionate guy. So that was tough on him, and that was really interesting to see. Buck was a little more matter of fact and kind of sedate, and but by that time they were kind of like a pair because they had done a lot of traveling together, and kind of Buck was the straight man,
Right.
and Don was always joking with him, but
No, because like I mean
it
we
was.
and having having seen the miniseries numerous times and having read the book, so I mean it's a known fact that Buck broke down at us at the point where after seeing all his friends getting decimated and injured. So my question is, did he still also carry that emotional weight when he was back in Belgium, in those areas, when you're going through the tour and stuff like that?
Yeah, when I can remember, and I can't remember if it was, I think it was on that tour, so it had been after the series had been out for a little while. Don was we were talking about it, and Don, thought the series did a great job, but he did not like how Buck was portrayed. Buck was evacuated with trench foot. He had severe trench foot. It seemed like everybody was exhausted. And Buck being, a leader, so with that level of responsibility, But part of the reason he got trench foot is that he was out and moving all the time.
Right.
And so, I understand later that Buck himself was not pleased. He didn't say anything about it at the time, to me, but Don did. And so it and you'll see that in the series, and it's one thing. You know, I see the series several times a year and I talk to people about it, and there are things that are clearly, I mean, the series knocked it out of the park. But it's not a documentary. So there are
Exactly.
elements of, you know, creating characters. Like one of the things I spend,
Why?
yeah, I spend a great deal of my time, or one thing I focus on, like day one, I said, people are complex, particularly people in combat. You know, Dick Winters wasn't pure good. Herbert Sobel wasn't pure evil. Herbert
Correct.
Sobel is a very complex character, and the series very deliberately portrays him as like this, you
As a
know,
villain, yeah.
yeah, a villain. Yes, he was terrible at land navigation. True. Was he?
How did he get through OCS? I don't understand
Well, and that's the thing is,
that.
well, is he had actually he well he had had a commission prior to World War II. He just he had been a reserve officer prior to the war. In the book and in the miniseries, like there's the wonderful scene with the spaghetti in Toccoa where all
Yes.
the guys are throwing up, and
Exactly.
they and Sobel's yelling at him, and then they all pull together and they start singing, and then Sobel's character stops and looks upset. And
Right.
no, that is exactly what he wanted. He wanted them to pull together. He wanted them to be a team. He, yes, they were the best company because he was so hard on them. And
That's right. I mean, I've said numerous times he was an amazing instructor slash commander, but he was just a terrible leader.
yes,
That was the
and
problem.
in fact, when he goes to Chilton Foliot, and if you look at the timeline of when there's the NCO revolt, and then
Right.
Sobel gets assigned to Chilton Foliot, is the orders had come down from division. They needed a jump school, and that assignment goes to the 506, so it goes to Bob Sink. So, you know, Max Taylor says, Sink, go set up a jump school. And one thing that in talking to lots of people who knew Bob Sink personally, in fact, his youngest daughter lives up here near me, Robin,
Oh,
and
wow.
a lovely woman, and is that, you know, Bob Sink was someone who knew his men. And he knew he was one of his gifts was being able to put the right people in the right place. What he did is what it's looking like, and we're honestly trying to find documentation to show it, was that even if nothing had happened, if everything was going just great, was easy company, the chances are Bob Sink still would have chosen Herbert Sobel to run the jump school at Chilton Foliot because he was the best guy to do it. If there was anybody in the 506th who could take a bunch of, you know, chaplains and doctors and dentists and, you know, these specialists who needed to get shoved through airborne training, it would have been Herbert Sobel. And so his relief from Easy Company and his assignment to Chilton Foliot wouldn't have been considered a demotion. Yes, to lose your company before going into combat is one thing, but he had stood the company up since day one in 1942.
Right.
So he had already been in command of the company for over 2 years, or almost 2 years by the time of D-Day. And he's a captain and he's needed elsewhere, truly. By the way, he jumps on D-Day. He has a combat infantryman's badge. He's portrayed throughout the remainder of the series as, you know, just sort of showing up, and he's always in a nice clean uniform, and then oh, he's the supply guy.
Right.
Yeah, but he's the supply guy in an airborne regiment or airborne battalion. There is no soft, cushy office for you. It's funny when you look at elite units like airborne, and you'll look at someone like Herbert Sobel or other guys and go, oh, they're weak or they're lazy or they're terrible. Well, your baseline is different than like a regular infantry unit.
That's true, also, yes.
I have literally sat in a room with a bunch of, Delta Force operators, special forces guys, going, oh, Doug's a, weenie. He's fat and lazy. Okay, their baseline for what they consider fat and lazy is a little different than the
Exactly.
rest of us mortals.
That's true.
So it's interesting to look at leadership, and we do talk a lot about that with Norman Dyke, with Ron Spears, with guys who rise to the top like Carwood Lipton. And so, on the tour, and as we're following the series, 99% of the time, they've got the personalities right. But we try and go into a little more detail and go, yes, the series showed this, but then this also happened, because there are things that have to be condensed. I mean,
Of
it's a
course.
10-hour series, but it's
I
not
think
the
they wanted
war.
it, right. I think they wanted it to be 14 episodes at the beginning or something like that. And they had to cut it down and they had to cut things out and things like that.
Something as simple as the episode The Last Patrol, and they show Johnny Martin leading the patrol across the river there in Hagenau, when in fact it was Ken Mercier, and that the script had actually been written with Ken Mercier leading the patrol, but the decision was made. Mercier was a sergeant, Toccoa man, but was that they couldn't introduce a brand new character 8 episodes into the series because he had not been in any of the previous episodes. So that was a conscious decision to make. Okay, we'll have Johnny Martin.
Right, and it probably also they were introducing, Tom Hanks' son in that episode, so you can't.
Who, by the way, when you think nepotism, sorry,
I didn't think
if.
that. That wasn't what I was referring to. I was just saying
No,
that,
no, no.
I know
And that's one of the.
Colin Hanks is a great actor. There's no question about that.
And he also looks just like Hank Jones. And that was one of the things when, and talking to some of the, like Bruce McKenna, the screenwriter, and some of the pre-production people before the series, was I was talking to one of the researchers, and he had a big binder with all these photos of the guys. And he said, yeah, they hadn't started the casting process yet. And it was like, we want actors that look and can act like the original men. And so, that's why Frank John Hughes, he looks like Bill Garnier. He got his Philly accent down. The young kid who plays Babe Heffron, I mean, all of them across the board, they phenomenal job. And that Colin Hanks, and one of the things I do is when we're in Hagenau, I show a picture of Colin Hanks as Hank Jones next to a photograph of
Of Hank
the
Jones.
actual Lieutenant Hank
Oh,
Jones.
wow.
And so he wouldn't have gotten the job if he didn't look like the man he was portraying.
Right.
And yes, he's a wonderful actor and he does a phenomenal job. But it's interesting, he just looked like Hank Jones.
No, my point, what I was trying to say is that you're not gonna add in a new character when you're focusing on, Hank Jones. He's the new character. He's the new guy who doesn't know anything about that. And you're not gonna bring in some other character. Because then you have to start explaining why you're doing that too, even though he's been around the whole time. I understand that for sure.
And yeah, so it's hard to go, oh, by the way, we're going to introduce an original Toccoa man that you haven't seen in 8 episodes, and here he is. So there are certain things that, one of the Forrest Guth, who's a very well-known member of the company, they actually, the costume designer or the costume director was a guy named Joe Hobbs. Brett looked like the big bopper, had this amazing mane of hair. Great singer, but he also, Joe said, yeah, we had everything set up for Forrest Guth. They had uniforms and everything set up, but his character had been in some of the screenplays, but when they realized the number of characters that they could realistically, get people to follow,
And
Forrest
remember who they are.
unfortunately got, and remember who they are. Which that does bring me up one thing that Joe, I met Joe Hobbs in New Orleans, So they had just started, they were had started production in England, and Joe had flown over to come to the reunion and the opening of the D-Day Museum. And he talked about when he was when he got the job and he goes in to meet Tom Hanks, and he says he showed up wearing a proper paratrooper jumpsuit, and he had wings on. And the first thing Hanks says is, "Do you deserve to wear those wings?" And he had actually just gone through an airborne school in the Netherlands and done five jumps, and so, but he said the neatest thing was that Tom Hanks said, "Okay, make it right. Money is no option." And so Joe, like a kid in a candy store, went out, and one of the green jumpsuits that all the guys wear in Toccoa, and during their training, it's a material called herringbone twill, and it's a type of woven cotton. And Joe said, "All right, 100%, we're going to make this accurate." They found a factory somewhere, I believe in China, that could make a 100% accurate reproduction of World War II herringbone twill using the same weight of cotton and the whole nine yards. Well, the problem was, is once they got it and they got uniforms made, it's like, okay, we now need to age these so they look like they've been worn. Herringbone twill is a very resilient material, and it take and so they couldn't age it. So they actually had to go back and remake these, get more fabric that they could actually fade, and make and wear out quicker than the actual material because they had done it so
Wow.
accurately. And then yeah, and then Joe would make an effort to sprinkle original uniform items, real World War II pieces of equipment, you know, a tie here or pouches or th throughout the production. So some of the stuff that the guys are wearing are genuine World War II stuff, not things that were made for the series.
Wow, that's really cool. That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
It really is. So here, so now I have a question. You mentioned before that you met Spears a few times, and that you've had some conversations with him and stuff like that. What do you think? Are they tall tales, or are they, or is it real?
I no, I personally didn't meet Ron Spears, but I do have this. I happened to be there on Utah Beach when I saw Dick Winters kind of walking across, and I see another older guy walking across, and they kind of stop and look at each other, and then they walk up and I see him shake hands. And at the moment, I didn't recognize Ron Spears. Now, my friend and mentor Chris Anderson, who again had known Dick Winters since he was a kid, he had never met Ron Spears either. Spears went to some reunions early on, but then he had a full career in the army, so he was off doing other things. But for the flight from New York to Paris, where HBO, you know, had everybody in the families and the actors, I was already in Normandy, but Chris says he winds up sitting next to Ron Spears.
Wow.
And he said they chatted for like 5 hours, and they talked, you know, sports and all kinds of different things. And then I remember talking to Chris a couple years later, and we were talking about this, and he said, "Yeah," he says, "after watching the series, you know, and having that chance to just sit and just chat with Ron Spears, you go, yeah, got it right, nailed it." Which is an interesting the because the kid who played Spears is a guy named Matt Settle. I keep saying kids when, you
Yeah,
know, they're probably all in their 40s now, but they were kids then.
No,
In 2000,
they're older than their 40s because, it's
yeah,
25 years since.
that's right. I'm almost 60, so
Yeah.
so Matt Settle, who played Ron Spears, I think it was in Phoenix. Yes, Phoenix 2003. I spent 3 days with getting Kahluas for Babe Heffron. I was a captain in the army at the time, and Babe just really liked the idea that he could go, "Hey, Captain, can I get another Kahlua?" HBO's picking up the bar tab. So, Matt Settle was there, and had a chance and was sitting down and was chatting with him about, you know, his preparation. And he said, Yeah, he was the only actor who was portraying someone who was still a veteran who was still alive, but who did not got to at a minimum talk to that veteran on the phone. So all the actors that were portraying then living veterans, most of them got to visit with the veterans, and so many of them became friends of the family. The kid who played Skip Muck is, close with the whole Muck family in Tonawanda, New York, and but so and so Matt said, he goes, he didn't get to talk to Ron Spears. Nobody had contact information for him. And he spoke to some of the other veterans about him, but he said to prepare himself when he kind of got a sense of who Ron Spears was. Matt says he sat down and he said, I watched every awful, horrible movie I could, Faces of Death and all of, just to try and like numb himself. And you see it in his performance. He's kind of got the, and then to listen to Chris after talking to Ron say, yeah, he nailed it. Now, regarding the shooting of the prisoners, I asked Don about that once, and Don's answer was very interesting. He just kind of said, I will never judge what another man does in combat. So I suspect that it happened in some form. And that Spears had shot one of his NCOs. I understand that to be true based on a whole bunch of other information, because that guy was putting the lives of Spears's men, his platoon, in danger. The funny thing is that most of the guys in Easy Company, until Ron Spears took over, they had no idea who he was. Don had seen him, even though he was at Break Corps, he comes in at the
He
end,
didn't even get a medal at
and
Break Corps,
it's
which I find really interesting.
yeah, because he
Because he only got one
yeah,
medal.
well, and because it was winners, winners got, rightly so, and
Distinguished
I know they've tried to put him in for, yeah, Medal of Honor, and the Army has come back, quite rightly said, no, he absolutely deserved the Distinguished Service Cross, which, with Army regulations and medals, 100%. Medal of Honor, what he did not reach that level.
It wasn't because they couldn't give more than one person, on a given day or some crazy.
Yeah,
It sounds like
there
bullshit,
was that crazy
but whatever.
thing. No, and that's true. It's absolutely ridiculous that there was, okay, one Medal of Honor, for Normandy. But years later, when the miniseries comes out, there was a move to resubmit Dick Winters for the Medal of Honor for Brave Corps, citing that, this limitation. When the Army did in fact go back and look at it, yes, he deserved the Distinguished Service Cross, the number two medal for valor. That and oh, by the way, Brave Corps was never taught at West
Oh,
Point.
really?
I still see stuff. Oh yeah. And it is an absolute, and you see this with Winters all the time. Winters was a phenomenal tactician. He knew the manuals inside and out, and the attack on Brave Corps was an absolute textbook hasty attack. So yes, they teach, and they taught at West Point how to conduct a
But not
hasty
because
attack,
of
but they did
Winters.
not teach, not because they never taught Brave Corps. And trust me, I know enough nerdy West Point guys that they have gone back and they've gone through class syllabi, back into the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, and Brave Corps was never taught.
So
It was a ten.
how can they then make that as a statement? I mean, obviously, as you said before, this isn't a documentary, but still, to give that information
Yeah.
is just,
And I just read something quite recently again that talked about, this being taught at West Point, and somewhere along the line it gets conflated. And that's one of the interesting things to see over time is that, it's like, yeah, this is a textbook hasty attack like they teach you at West Point. And suddenly that became, oh, they teach this at West Point. But then you have things like Albert Blythe, where Albert Blythe retired as a Army Master Sergeant. He did two combat jumps in Korea with the 187th Airborne Regimental Combat Team. Albert, I know his son lives here in Seattle. And the miniseries still says that Albert Blythe died in 1947.
There's two things that always really bother me about the miniseries, about the factual events. And now that you've enlightened me, now there will be three. But one of them is Blythe, okay, and the other one is Liebgott. How they completely got it wrong because Liebgott was not Jewish. I
He's
know. And
Catholic.
for them to constantly, that there's even, because I'm looking at the series, in such minute detail, even in the first part, when they're in the middle of training, when Sobel, who himself was a Jew, is berating the men and giving them demerits and telling them that they're he's canceling all their leaves. So, he has a little longer conversation with Liebgott saying, "How do you plan on killing Germans, with a rusty bayonet and stuff like that?" And you can feel the undertone there where it's supposedly a Jew talking to a Jew about this. And the scene when they get to the concentration camp is very emotional and everything like that. And the way that Ross McCall plays the character, it's also is great, but it's all bullshit. That's the thing. It's like, how can you
And
get
well,
somebody
and
like that
think of
wrong?
the fight between he and Garnier on the
That's
troop
right.
ship.
Exactly.
Yeah, and there are little things like there's that. Okay, Webster. I don't seen anything where Webster is a German translator. Webster was actually not on the last patrol. He was right across the river manning a 50 caliber machine gun in Observation Post 2. But they're telling the story
From his
through,
perspective,
with Webster and Hank Jones. Yes, Hank Jones was there. In fact, there's a story that they were running patrols across the river. I know we're jumping around here.
No, that's okay.
But
I'm familiar enough, and
there's
hopefully
a
everyone listening will be either already are familiar enough or will become familiar enough when they get through listening to all of these episodes. So that's fine.
Well, yes, listen, if you're coming in cold to Band of Brothers, this is probably not the place to start. Go
No.
watch the series,
Yeah.
then listen.
Okay.
I've read several different accounts of the last patrol. From one is from a guy who was in Able Company who said, "Yeah, I heard this," and he actually conflates the E Company last patrol with a patrol with Fox Company,
Oh,
where that there was a lieutenant who came in with Hank Jones. And by the way, Hank Jones was a star. West Point volunteered for the infantry, volunteered for airborne. Was he and a bunch of other guys get assigned to the 13th Airborne Division, which is then in England, and there's a need, the 101st needs lieutenants, and Jones volunteers. So and the accounts that I've read of him say, yeah, he was there for about, I think he was with the company for about 2 weeks. And but that the guys, he was a good leader. He didn't have combat experience. He would get it on that one patrol, but that one of those fellow lieutenants got assigned to Fox Company, goes along as an observer on a similar cross river patrol and hits a shoe mine and is killed. And while I was in Hagenau and I'm talking about this, one of my guests is diligently doing some homework on Google and actually comes back and, oh yes, I believe his name is Fitzpatrick, and there was a letter to his family saying how, saying your son died leading his men in combat, and he's missed and all of this. And my tour group was like, "Oh my God, that's so beautiful." And I said, "It is, and it's complete bullshit." I said, "This lieutenant," and the thing is, this lieutenant was with that company for maybe 4 hours. And no, he wasn't leading. Again, absolutely nothing against him. And I understand the similar event. My ex-wife had an uncle who was killed in World War II, and everyone in the family said, yeah, he was a Marine and he was killed on Iwo Jima, and he was shot by a sniper and died instantly. And we went and visited his grave in the Punch Bowl in Hawaii, where I was actually yesterday. I was there for the Pearl Harbor anniversary, but it turns out, no, he wasn't in the Marines. He was in the Army, and he wasn't on Iwo Jima. He was killed in Okinawa, and he was killed in Okinawa about a week or two before the whole Battle of Okinawa ended. And he had been with his company less than 2 weeks, and I spoke with some veterans of that re of the regiment, and he said, we didn't know who anybody was. Replacements were just getting fed in, and it was a
Right.
meat
Again,
grinder.
anyone who's seen
And
Hacksaw Ridge knows how
absolutely. And so I actually got this guy's military records, and it included a letter to his mother from his company commander saying, Bill was a great guy. We all loved him. We miss him so much. He died instantly. He was in no pain. And again, the family's like, that's beautiful. And I'm like, it is, but it's not true. Though I'm very happy that that's the letter that went to
That's
his
right.
mother and gave her comfort, but it's absolutely
Yes.
not true.
Again, it's part of the problem.
So,
There's, not everyone is going to die in a heroic way in battle, and you therefore still need to make it seem as if that their death was for a purpose.
absolutely. And that's a tough thing for leaders because, yeah, n not everyone is a hero. And people, everybody does their job. I don't know how many veterans I've run across who said, oh, I didn't do anything. I was a cook. And I'm like, what you did, trust me, what you did
You were
was
able to make
important.
army
I
noodles
met a.
with ketchup, so
Yes,
that
exactly. Or what the Australians call cooks, fitters and turners, is they fit food into a pot and turn it into shit. So I always like
that's
that
good.
expression. So gosh, so when I'm with guests and we're telling these stories, and I want to be very deliberate about, I'm not sharpshooting and I'm not nitpicking at the series or the book. Again, I say, they knocked it out of the park. And I remember very vividly in both during the miniseries premiere in France and a year or two later when I got to meet a bunch of the actors again at one of the reunions, is how they were all, Hanks and Spielberg were, this is not a job. This is a privilege. This is an honor. And all these young kids were like that. They were, I can remember riding the bus to the farewell dinner in Paris, and I was actually in uniform. All these Scott Grimes, who
Mark,
played
yes.
Don Mularkey, I know was on the bus. Or Bart, yes, Scott Graf, who and now I'm blanking on the kid who played George Luz, he was sitting in the seat with his girlfriend in front, and first of all the guys were just like, yes sir, no sir. I'm like, dudes, my name's Aaron, stop
Rick
it.
Gomez.
Rick Gomez, yes. I actually at the D-Day 80th anniversary, summer before last, at the ceremony at the cemetery, I was talking with George Luz, and Rick Gomez was coming out because the actors got to be a part of, they got the good seats. And it was and he and George Luz are still, very, very good friends. But that these young guys, and I was chatting with them and trying to get them to not call me sir, but they had just been through all this training with the series. And but that each one of them said, yeah, this was, we were told this is an honor to get to do that. And I've seen things with the actors today. They still go, best. the most, it's like the most real
Right. Well,
thing they
again,
ever got to do.
how many actors are 25 years later still getting together with the, with the guys they made a miniseries with 25 years earlier? It's rare. It's very rare.
Yeah.
So.
It is. And the way that, these guys, bond together, and were bonded together, and the way David Schwimmer went through his military training completely separate from, so yeah, did a such a good
For sure.
job with it.
Well, Eric, this has been so fascinating. You've enlightened me to so many different things. This is great.
I'm
This is
glad. It's
great.
been
This
fun,
truly
Rob.
is. So thank you very much for joining me. Is there anything else you want to leave this with? Leave with us.
Continue to be curious, check your sources, but just under under it's still such a great story, and it still resonates today, and as a testament to how important it is to people, that I still get to take people across Europe
Right.
and tell their story, and that people are still interested, and that it's an extraordinary story. And Rob, the fact that you're taking your time and covering it as well is a
For
testament to
sure,
that.
for
And
sure.
it's great. So thank you.
You're very welcome. So thank you very much. So I will be back tomorrow with another guest, but until then, curry.
Hurry.